On this episode of Wild in the Streets, we're headed back to Milan, where a former gangster is dodging his old colleagues in Fernando Del Leo's 1972 classic, Caliber 9. Hello and welcome to Wild in the Streets, a deep dive into the Eurocrime films of the 1970s and beyond. I'm Doug Tilley, and with me as always is L'Americano Liam O'Donnell. How you doing today, Liam?
I'm pretty good, Doug. How you doing? What's going on?
Hey, don't pull it back on me. Nothing is going on, Liam. All I'm focused on are these wonderful action movies, action-packed movies of the 1970s and sometimes 1980s that we've been featuring on this program. Last episode, we had a little experience with Jean-Paul Belmondo. We both enjoyed that very much. This time we're going back to something very familiar in terms of territory, back to the Italian crime films, the poliziotteschis of the 1970s. And it's exciting to go to one of the all-time classics that we hadn't yet covered on the show, Caliber 9. Liam, was this your first experience with Caliber 9?
Yeah, the only movie I've seen from this director is The Boss. You know, Il Boss, I guess. I had never seen this one, or the more well known isn't the other one he did is Italian Connection, right? Or
yes, which like we covered on this very program, the Italian Connection.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, we've actually covered a number of Fernando Del Leo projects, both directing and writing. On this,
right, but I was thinking of like this is Caliber 9 is like part of the trilogy, which is weird because he's done other stuff, but like these are a particular trilogy. I did not remember we covered Italian Connection. I'm so embarrassed by that.
You may remember that one of the leads of this film, the gentleman who plays Rocco, Mario Adorf, mm-hmm. He was the star of the Italian Connection. He does a lot of his own stunts in it. It was quite impressive.
I don't know why I don't remember.
Me either.
I really was like, oh, yeah, I've never caught that one. And it's like, yeah, whatever. I don't know. I'm an idiot. Who cares?
You're not an idiot, Liam. It's just that I do sometimes find that a lot of the movies that we cover on this program, they meld together, particularly because they both have a similar feel, but also they have a very similar look. So sometimes it's hard to distinguish. And it has to be something particularly odd, like Live Like a Cop, Die Like a Man, where it's or some of the Thomas Millian starring ones, which really kind of distinguish themselves because of performances and some of the weird content. But, you know, something like this, I wouldn't say it's necessarily standard. I really liked Caliber 9. I don't want to give too much away. But if someone told me later about a scene from it, I could easily confuse that with like seven other movies we've covered so far.
The issue actually, Doug, is that this whole time I was transmogrifying the Italian Connection into the Italian Job, which I've never seen. Right. And then as soon as I opened it up on IMDb, I'm like, oh, right, this movie with Henry Silva and the hitman. And oh, right, I'm an idiot. Like, it immediately clicked for me. And then I realized, like, oh, right, I'm thinking of the Italian Job, which is nothing like this movie. I'm a dingbat. But yes, yeah, we did cover the Italian Connection.
The Italian Job, of course, not being an Italian crime film at all.
No, not at all. That's why I was so confused why it doesn't matter. Go ahead.
No, it doesn't matter, though. I'm glad that you brought it up because I believe, am I wrong that the Italian Job stars, Michael Caine. Is that correct?
Yes.
And when I watched this movie, I was thinking of Michael Caine a lot because something about this particular movie, Caliber 9, reminded me of those kind of British tough guy crime movies of the late 60s, early 70s, like Get Carter and things like that. Yeah. Now, this has a different feel, certainly, because it is more tied into, especially like the politics of Italy at the time period. But it kind of, the very fact that it focuses more on the criminals, which is something that you said that you were excited about, the idea of this focusing more on criminals rather than the police. The police are very backgrounded in this movie.
Oh, very much.
And that's I it kind of connected in my mind a little bit. So I'm really curious to get your thoughts on that. But before we do, Liam, I have a couple of things I want to talk to you about. The first is a YouTube video that I sent over to you. Now, this is a commercial from, I think at this point, maybe 13, 14 years ago, maybe even a little more than that. And it's called Milano Calibro Kobe. And this was a commercial for Nike shoes. You ever wear Nike shoes before, Liam?
No.
Okay. They're a shoe brand, very popular by some people.
Yeah, I've heard of them.
Shoes are pretty big. Are you a shoe head? Gearhead? Is that what they call them?
I believe it's Sneakerhead.
Sneakerhead, is that what it is? Mm-hmm. Are you a sneaker pimp like the band?
No.
Okay. You wear sneakers?
Not a lot anymore, no.
Okay. All right. Do you have anything else to say?
Nope. No, I have a lot of friends who love Nike. I don't really care about it. I will say, I've never bought my own pair of Nikes. However, for a brief period of time, friend of the show, Chris Reject, figured out a scam where he could buy shoes and other things through a specific website that wasn't the Nike site, but a different site, use them for a while, and then send them back for a refund.
Okay.
And they were okay with giving you the refund because it wasn't in cash. It was in some other thing. But then he could use that other thing in a way that turned into cash. So he, in his mind, was like making money. I didn't understand it, but what he did was he just kept buying us Nikes for the shop, and we'd wear them in the shop, and then at a certain point he's like, all right, give me the shoes back, so he could like mail back. So hopefully you had your other shoes with you the day he needed the shoes back so that you had shoes to wear home.
This is the first potential criminal enterprise that's been talked about.
Oh yeah, I guess this could be a whatever, it's fine. Who cares?
What was the method by which he made it back into cash?
Bro, if I knew, I would have already said that part. Doug, do you think of me as someone who doesn't share everything? If I knew how it worked, I would explain the entire thing. I never understood what was happening. All I knew is he'd give me these Nikes, and the ones that he gave me were like the ones with the weird like slip-on interior sock thing. So I would never wear socks with them. So these were like some fucked shoes that he was sending back. And I was just like, all right, if you say so, buddy.
Well, someone's making money somewhere. Liam, back to this commercial. So this is basically a fake trailer starring Enzo Castiglione, who is well-known exploitation Italian director of the 1970s, directed the original Inglourious Basterds. I say original as if the Quentin Tarantino one is a remake. It's not. It's more like a tribute that uses the same name, slightly different spelling for it. But Enzo actually appears in this, and it's set up to be a fake trailer for a 70s Eurocrime movie, except starring very famous athletes. Who are some of these famous athletes, Liam?
Well, one is Kobe Bryant. Yes. I know that person. And then other people.
And other people. Some very famous football players. And when I say football, of course, I mean the international football, Liam, not the American football or Canadian football. Some of the athletes include Marco Bellinelli, Claudio Marchisio, Marco Materazzi. I'm going to stop right there. These are famous players, and I apologize for both not being able to pronounce their names and also for not knowing who the hell they are. But they're very famous, and they're all playing the roles of these kind of cliched criminals who are, I guess the plot of it is that people are stealing different balls. So they're stealing basketballs, and they're stealing soccer balls or football balls, I guess. Footballs, I guess you would call them. And then Kobe Bryant is called in from the U.S. He's the Black Mamba. He comes in to track down, I don't really understand the plot, but it ends with like a confrontation between a football player and a basketball player played by Kobe. They do some dribbling. It's very exciting. And then we find out that the ball that Kobe has thrown to the football player is a bomb and it explodes. And that's the end of it. So what did you think of this commercial, Liam?
It's just confused. I mean, it looks all right. Like I like the idea that it's sort of recreating that retro thing, but whenever they try to make these commercials that are like more than a commercial and have a little plot and whatever, they're never charming. I don't understand this sort of move. And the whole thing was just kind of like, all right, what are we doing here? Why does this matter? What's happening? It wasn't very compelling. And I know part of that is our fault because we don't know the football players, involved. So maybe it would be more interesting if we were sportos. But as a non-sporto, I just didn't really care.
I that was part of the problem for me. I think part of the fun of this is supposed to be, hey, look, it's that guy, that person I recognize. It's also kind of strange, the intermingling of all of these famous football players and Kobe Bryant, just because he has a contract with Nike. And Kobe, who's a controversial figure, to say the very least, and is also dead. Not the most expressive or charismatic actor, so that doesn't help this either. It does have a fun look, though. It's got it very much. I think this was coming out around the time probably that Grindhouse was coming out, the Quentin Tarantino Robert Rodriguez project. So it has all the beat up like fake grain and stuff like that in it, and that's fun to watch. So I'm glad that they made something that is such a unique tribute to the kind of movies that we cover on this very podcast. I just didn't necessarily enjoy it very much. It wasn't very funny. That's my problem.
Yeah, I think if there was a...
Oh, boy.
Well, Doug, I was going to keep going. You could edit around it. If there was like some jokes in it that really landed... here's the thing. It's trying to nail the tone of one of these kind of movies, which means none of the humor is very good. And right. I would prefer something that was a bit more silly. Like, the tone should be closer to, like, I'm going to get you, sucker, than an actual, like, Italian crime movie, you know?
Yeah, no, very much so. And there's all obviously only so much you can do in 3 minutes anyway. Though I say that when, like, surrounding that time period of that Grindhouse release were all those fake trailers, right, where people fit in a lot more jokes than they fit into this fucking thing. So maybe I don't know what I'm talking about, Liam.
I mean, you usually don't.
Liam, as you already kind of made reference to, this film that we're going to be talking about today, Caliber 9, is the first part of Fernando de Leo's Emilio trilogy of Polizio Teschi films. We've already covered the second in that trilogy, The Italian Connection, and the third is Il Boss, a.k.a. The Boss from 1973, which I'm sure we'll get to at some point. We're going into these in a non-chronological order. It doesn't really matter because they're very much a thematic trilogy about kind of the criminal underworld of Milan and sort of the inner workings and also the inner turmoil of those who are part of that system. And I don't remember a lot about the details of the plot of The Italian Connection, but I will say that of all the films that we've covered on Wild in the Streets, Caliber 9 is a little different in terms of who it focuses on, right? The criminal mm-hmm. at its center is a very kind of stoic, silent type. We don't really know where his head is at. And I think that makes for an interesting and kind of unique character to be following around, though he's a bit of a blank slate. So it takes the supporting players to have to be a little more charismatic and a little over the top, which I'm sure we'll get into in just a little bit.
Well, it's also not always clear exactly what the criminal enterprise is that they're engaged in. Like,
that's true.
The American, like, he does something, and the one police officer is convinced that if they nail him, they'll nail a whole network of people. But other than, like, he works with other people's money, it's not clear what other crimes. And the one thing we get to see our main character participate in just involves blowing up two random guys, which I still don't understand why they had to be blown up. Like, I don't – it's never clear exactly what's being accomplished in those two assassinations, you know?
I'll explain it to you, Liam. They run a criminal enterprise where they have bags that have to be swapped constantly, and some of those bags have bombs, and some have money, and people seem to be confused about which one is which. Sometimes the ones that are supposed to have money just have pieces of paper in them, but often they're just bombs. I'm with you. It's not always clear because you never actually see the kind of general criminality that they're supposed to be part of. It's not, you know, if they do smuggling, we don't see it. But I guess it's enough to know that they're criminals and that they're violent for some reason, and also that they are part of a new generation of criminality that doesn't act with honor, I suppose. You know, there's this big conversation about how they're not really the mafia, right? That the police just considers all these criminals the mafia, but the mafia had, you know, rules that they followed. Mm-hmm. And these days, Liam, there just ain't no rules.
To be fair, the one police officer is convinced they're all anarchists, which I thought was a very funny thing and reflective of the I mean, if someone isn't familiar with this time in Italian history, they might think that that was just an offhand joke, when in reality, that was a real thing, that all this stuff was going on, not just with the criminal organizations, but with right-wing terror groups. And the cops were just like, it was those fucking anarchists, man. You got to get the leftists. They're doing everything. And it's like, you know, historically, it often wasn't. It was often some other weird thing going on, you know? So that part made me laugh a good deal. I think the weird thing about this movie, Doug, that we'll get into, is how some of the irony and comic relief was from these useless cops that don't really do anything. And I just thought that was such a funny choice, especially since one of the cops is apparently like a sympathetic liberal, which I thought was a really weird choice.
It's a really strange choice. We'll talk about the fact that the director later regretted having those scenes in the movie entirely, but we'll talk about that in just a little bit. As per usual, we're using the Italian crime filmography by Roberto Curti as sort of the Bible for the show. When it comes to Caliber 9, he has this to say. He says, the way De Leo effectively synthesizes the escalation of a new form of criminality replacing the old one. As Don Vincenzo says, they call it the mafia, but they're just gangs. Gangs fighting each other. The real mafia does not exist anymore. When drug dealers want to invest their earnings, they build apartment blocks so the construction gangs kill them. Where's the mafia in that? The real mafia is gone. The difference between the old and new criminality is a matter of methods and mentality, something which had been understood very well by the American, whose motto is, do unto others as they would do to you before they do it. An aberration to those who still follow old concepts such as honor, respect, rules, which actually no one follows anymore. Liam, do you think that's realistic to the actual circumstances in Italy in the 1970s, or was that just sort of a romantic idea of older criminals who may or may not have actually followed a set of rules?
I assume it's a romantic idea, especially because it's not like assassination was any less common, you know, with the older sort of generation. But I do think it's, there's a certain amount, when it comes to the history of organized crime in Italy, there's a certain history of myth-making where it's hard to penetrate that veil. But not all of it is untrue, right? Like, we know that there were these organizations that sometimes that they were connected very much by, like, where they were from, that they went back, they were sometimes were very historical. Like, a lot of these details are connected to reality, but in portraying it fictionally, you always are, or people are often going to make it into one sort of thing. Like, there just is the mob and it is this thing. And I think that that is obviously a simplification. As far as the idea of, like, no one has honor anymore, I don't know. I think, Doug, I've been corrupted a little bit by The Godfather and movies like that, where the big shift is drugs, right? Or I guess even more so with Scorsese.
Mean Streets. Oh, you're talking about Goodfellas.
Goodfellas, thank you. And that's, my brain kept saying Mean Streets, and I'm like, not Mean Streets. The idea that, like, there was maybe something around, you know, let's say rules does not mean kindness, right? Like,
of course.
Discipline does not mean you're not hurting people, right? But there was a discipline about what was okay, and that something about the drug trade changed all that is sort of the narrative we see in the U.S. a lot. I don't know if that is A, accurate anywhere, and B, if it reflects the Italian sort of attitude. I do think it's interesting, now that I'm remembering that this is the person who did The Italian Connection, that's another movie focused on an American, right? Like, there's an American who's come to Italy, and the two hitmen are sent to take care of him.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's interesting that all these, that at least these two movies are dealing with this, like, American the relationship between Americans and the Italian sort of crime situation. But I don't know. I think everybody wants to believe, well, maybe not everybody, but a lot of people want to believe that the past was somehow golden in a way that the present is not. And that's probably just not true. Or it's probably what's more common, Doug, is that they did have all these rules, and then when people broke those rules, other people got really mad about it, but no one really followed them all the time, you know?
I do think that idea that it's the American influence that might be what's corrupting a lot of these old rules, whether it be realistic or not, is an interesting one. Also interesting in this movie, because the American is played by Lionel Stander, who was blacklisted for being a communist. He was one of the creators of the Screen Actors Guild, a guy who held his left his politics on his sleeve. Speaking of politics, there's a lot of interesting stuff in those conversations that we'll get to as well. Let us take a break, Liam. We're going to get into it after this break. 1972's Caliber 9.
Hugo, you got no choice. You got no choice. You're not going to get near that 300 grand because we ain't going to leave you alone for a stinking second. You ain't going to be able to take a piss unless one of us is there to pull a chain. We'll hound you. We'll be on every bus, on every train, at the airport.
If they kill you, that's okay with me, because I'll have one punk less to worry about.
What do you want? Protection, right?
We used to throw you guys in prison and let you rot. Now they tell us we got to take good care of our boys.
I'll tell you something you ought to know. One way or another, you're going to give back that 300 grand. One way or another.
Use your head.
I am using my head.
No, not for thinking.
A former gangster is forced to resume his old lifestyle when his violent, jealous ex-colleagues and the police believe that he knows the location of a stolen cache of $300,000. It's 1972's Caliber 9, also known as Milano Calibro 9, and it was directed by, as we've already said, Fernando Del Leo. We've actually heard his name several times in the past, not because not just because of the Italian connection, but he also wrote Live Like a Cop, Die Like a Man. He was involved in the writing of a number of the movies that we've covered on this podcast. I mean, he actually cut his teeth on like spaghetti westerns. Actually, you can kind of feel the spaghetti western influence on this movie as well, and other genres, but certainly made his name in the Eurocrime field. This was written by Fernando Del Leo alone, which is kind of a rarity for the kind of movies that we've been covering on this podcast so far. The cast, a lot of recognizable faces, but the most recognizable for me was Mario Adorf, who we've seen already in the Italian Connection, and is someone I'm definitely going to be talking about. But this stars Gaston Mostyn as Ugo Piazza, the kind of strong, somber lead character. We have the great Barbara Boucher as the female lead in it, who we later find out, spoiler alert, is a bit of a femme fatale. Also, some other familiar faces. I already mentioned Lionel Stander. And we also have Frank Wolfe from some of the early Roger Corman movies here as well as the commissario. And I knew I recognized him, but I wasn't sure for certain that he was American. But you could definitely tell that he's speaking English in his scenes. Liam, I know I've already kind of showed my hand a little in regards to how much I like this movie. But what did you think of Caliber 9?
I mostly like it, Doug. I am still a little conflicted on the ending, though not the big surprise, which you've already sort of spoiled for everybody. I'm assuming most people listening have heard it, which is that what is her character's name? I already forgot. I had it on my tongue.
I mean, it's really just on the screen in front of you, but it is Nellie Borden.
Thank you, Nellie. Nellie is so welcoming of him that I don't think it's weird to say that you might suspect early on that she is maybe not on the level, right? Especially considering in the movie that no one is on his side. He's utterly isolated. So the fact that she's the only person who seems to welcome him with open arms, you know, you might think like something's going on there. But the surprise that, and again, maybe this is my naivete, the surprise that I was not expecting is that he did in fact steal the money, right?
Yeah.
And so this is why I wasn't suspecting it. Not because I think it's weird or whatever. There's a character, Doug, that I'm sure you are familiar with in these sorts of movies, or I wouldn't even say this kind of movie, but more in noir films, which is the person who is stuck with a situation that is not their problem, right?
Absolutely.
But there's no way out of it. They are trapped by it.
Even the Hitchcockian kind of mistaken man type.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so something about this character's stoicism, and I really like the actor who plays Ugo, which, by the way, what a weird fucking name. But anyways.
Weird name, I do have to say. I also have to mention, Liam, that someone on one of the social media sites said that they were distracted by the fact that he looks like Homer Simpson in the movie. Do you think he looks like Homer Simpson?
No, I don't think he looks like Homer Simpson. I do think it's weird, though, because he, correct me if I'm wrong, Doug, does he also have blue eyes like Nellie does?
Oh, he might. I mean, I'm trying to think of it right now. I mean, he certainly has very intense eyes.
There's a moment where when they are first talking to each other where I know that they are lovers, but I thought he could play her father. That's weird. It really like they look similar in a way, and I just that part that kind of threw me off a little bit. But yeah, no, I think his performance is strong, but the idea that this whole time he's just been fucking doing a work, man. He's been working everybody because he's got the money and he knows that if he waits long enough, the Americano is going to fucking implode, do something stupid and get himself killed, and then he can run off with the money. It's not that on paper I don't think that's cool, but I was really invested in the other idea that he was just caught, right, in this situation that is not really his fault, or maybe it's his fault just by association, you know what I mean? But he's caught in this trap, and he's trying to find a way out. And in that scenario, the portrayal by Nellie would be that much more sharp, right? But the big reveal being not only is he getting portrayed by Nellie, but he stole the money. And then our man Rocco comes in and is like, I don't know, suddenly his defender, because he just thinks it's so hard ass that he pulled this fucking work off that now he's like committed to this guy. All of that was just not what I was expecting. And I've actually had trouble processing it to figure out if I like it or not. And, you know, in a way that's more my fault than the movie's fault, right? Because I got invested in something that wasn't real. But that being said, overall, yeah, I think it's a really enjoyable film. I think I really appreciate the performances. I will say I had a little trouble because I had to switch versions. The version I was watching, the subtitles did not make sense. and I had to switch to a different version. And then I found out that part of the reason the subtitles were off was because the version, there were some scenes cut in some versions of the movie. So I'm glad I switched, and that helped me sort of figure out what was going on with the film. But yeah, overall I liked it, but that ending still has me a little like unsure if I think it works or not.
I can see you're feeling conflicted with the ending. I do think that part of, and maybe you already know this, and I apologize if I'm telling you something you already know, Liam, that one of the reasons that Rocco turns his allegiance, or at least has a lot of respect for Ugo at the end, is not just because he, you know, kept it quiet that he had the $300,000, but that he basically manipulated the entire situation.
Right.
That, like, his Chino, who is like an older hitman who plays by the old rules that that Ugo goes to go see, like, he wants to create some sort of conflict with him and the Americano so that they will kill each other off, which is exactly what happens. It feels a little callous and bloodthirsty, because in the movie itself, you kind of like Chino, right? Because he seems like he has a sense of honor about him, and he also is a real badass when he comes out and starts murdering all those these criminals. And so I also felt a little conflicted at the end, but I could at least understand a little bit with Rocco, who is, you know, he's a sleazy piece of shit the entire time, but he also is someone who kind of needs a leader. So the idea that he would just turn his allegiance, like, I got nobody, I'm unruddered, this badass who just, you know, fix this entire situation, he's the guy that I'm going to turn to, that at least made sense to me. But I do feel like that whatever sympathy you may have had for Ugo at that time period, it kind of has, like, at the end, you don't feel as, you don't feel the betrayal as hard as you might otherwise if he had done two things. One, if he hadn't gone through all that manipulation, and B, if he hadn't actually stole the money the whole time. Though, right. I think the reveal that he actually stole the money is a great reveal. I love that part of the movie.
I think for me, it's like, it's almost like, I think it works, but because it worked on me, I don't like it. In that,
yeah,
the movie never actually gives you any good reason to like Ugo, other than the fact that the people who don't like him suck, right? Like, the cop who keeps harassing him sucks, the Americano and all the people who work for him fucking suck. So yeah. You just, and what's even more ridiculous is, because she turns out to be the worst, you kind of like Nelly. And so you see him, he's not like all these other assholes. Nelly seems okay, though I didn't quite trust that, but the presentation, she's okay. So you just start to be on his side, and there's no reason to be on his side. Nothing ever suggests that he's actually worth rooting for. So the reveal should just be like, not that big a surprise, because it's, you know, he is the criminal that he was made out to be. But I got invested in him, Doug. Yeah. And then I was like, oh, this whole thing was a big, that's what I meant when I said it was a work. It's not just that he has the money, it's that he's manipulating all these people to kill each other off so that he'll be able to walk away with the money. Utterly surprised. Did not see it coming. And really, that speaks to the quality of the film and the quality of the script, that, like, it really is like a pretty solid twist that I think will catch a good number of people who watch this movie. But I think I just got too personally invested in Ugo, partly because, like you said, he's stoic. I think he's not just stoic too. He's a little sad. He's a little, yeah, like, his vibe is very much like, I can't believe this shit is happening to me.
Yeah. You know, like, he has a doomed sense to him, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he's like, which is funny because like, even Nelly's like, she's just constantly, it's like, why don't you go to Beirut? Why don't you just grab the money and go to Beirut? And he even says to her, it's like, I don't have the money, I can't go. Or she offers to give him money, which is that kind of an odd thing when you think back on it. And he's like, I can't take the money because they'll think that it's the money that they think I already stole. So that, you know, he feels trapped. Now, whether you like him or not, or think that he's respectable or not, he is kind of a badass in that he will just, he stands up to all sorts of punishment in this, which I think also helps with the sympathy a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's true. But again, then it's like, he's really the ultimate, you know, he would be the villain if it wasn't the turn from Nelly is so gross. And, you know, the guy who shoots him that is working for Nelly, we realize he's been following Ugo the whole movie.
Yes.
I thought that guy worked for the Americano. And then when it's revealed that he's working for Nelly, it's even more like she's been setting this motherfucker up for a long time, you know?
Yeah, because when you think back, especially because you see that character, Luca, the person that shoots Ugo at the end, all throughout the movie, just in like little bits and pieces, you see him in the background and stuff. So, I mean, yeah, it's obviously, I mean, at least, It doesn't feel like a plot that was just made up on the spot. It feels like it was all meant to piece together. It's just that it leaves you with a few questions. I do want to talk about this performance by Mario Adorf as Rocco Musco, who's kind of the Americans' number one guy. He is the Americano's top thug. He has this amazing look. He has this gigantic chin and this little wispy mustache. And he is so excitable. Like, he's complete opposite of Ugo. He's always, like, he's laughing and joking, but he's also intimidating at the same time. Liam, I thought that his performance made this movie. What did you think of Rocco in this?
I mean, he's certainly the most interesting of the villains. Like, I think that while definitely the Americano is a bit of a turnoff, the other side villains, right, his henchmen, are just not that interesting. They're visually interesting, like the guy with the scar on his face.
Yeah, yeah.
But they don't do anything that makes them interesting. But he brings such a fucking energy, and it works so well with Ugo, considering, you know, his whole way of being menacing is being, you know, over the top, exuberant guy. And Ugo's response to that is just not to say anything.
Nope.
And the way that that front, like, it's funny because I feel like I'm more invested in Rocco's way of handling things. Like, I like that method. But it's clear that Ugo knows what the fuck he's doing, because the more that he doesn't say anything, the more Rocco kind of loses his fucking cool, right?
Like, yes, absolutely.
Becomes worse and worse at his job, honestly. And I appreciate that about the character. Plus, that actor, you know, Mario Adolf, I just like his vibe. It's always a certain kind of thing from him, and I appreciate that a lot.
And he's still with us at the age of 93. He was acting crazy, as of just a couple of years ago. That scene where Ugo is meeting up with Chino, and then Rocco and his men bust in, and they take the money out of Ugo's pocket and just ripped it to pieces. And then he completely switches things around, and it's more like Chino does it. Chino is so kind of threatening as this old school hitman badass, that even though they've just beat the shit out of both Ugo and Chino, Chino makes him take money out of his own pocket and put it back in Ugo's pocket, which I thought, that's a really interesting scene. I'm actually not sure necessarily how to read how the scale tipped into why one character was intimidated and then stopped being.
They did not, because A, they didn't beat him up. They hold their own once Ugo
jumps
in.
That's true, exactly.
And then B, they didn't know who this guy was. They're just, he's hanging out with Ugo. And then he says, asks Rocco what his name is, and he says, "Oh, I'm Rocco. I work for the Americano."
He said, "You should already know who I am." That's right.
Yeah, he says, "I'm Chino," and he goes, and then Rocco's literal response is, "I did not know that." And I'm like, I wonder if that's as funny of a response in Italian as it is, in English. It's like, oh man, that's a raw look. I wonder if it's like that in Italian, but it's very much like the reputation of who he is comes across. But again, he's living in this little apartment. He's not really doing any crime. There's a real feeling of like he's out to pasture. So there's an aspect of intimidation there, but I'm not surprised that also later on they're kind of like, this guy, you know, fuck him. He needs to get in line, you know, whatever. Yeah. It's a real like changing of the guard scenario, you know.
When we first are introduced to him, he's like laying on that little tiny bed, right? And he's taking care of the old Don and things like that. Yeah, you're right. It's like he's been put out to pasture, and then he's caught. In any other movie, he would be the main character, right? The guy called out of retirement to deal with this new element. Yeah, it's interesting. I do want to talk about those two police officers, the commissioner and the vice commissioner. Those scenes are really strange in this movie. I can see why later that Fernando Del Rio kind of wish that he didn't put them in, because he thought that it messed with the pacing of the movie as a whole. So you have Frank Wolf playing the commissario, who is like a ultra right wing guy, and then you have Luigi Pastilli as the vice commissario, who is like a socialist communist type guy, and they have these like debates in the movie right up to the point where the commissario gets so annoyed with him that he just gets him transferred, and then they have one more scene together. What are those scenes supposed to represent, do you think? Do you think it's just about the tension that existed in Italy in the 70s, where even the police officials have opposite political leanings? Not like today, where they're all the same and they all suck.
You know, I don't actually know, because it's hard for me, Doug, because I don't know what the vibe I'm supposed to get from each of the police is supposed to be. Like, it seems clear to me that the right wing main commissario that he is shitty and bad at his job, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All he does is harass Ugo and gets nothing for it. And so I assume the message is supposed to be not that I like this dude, it's that I don't like this dude. But then I'm not sure that the other guy is super compelling in his social arguments when we don't really see any of these sympathetic criminals that he's talking about, right? Like, he's trying to make the argument that, like, a lot of these folks are just in a situation that they can't help, and this is sort of the best that they can do. And I find that compelling. Like, what he says in the movie a lot of times is compelling to me, and yet the movie doesn't seem to really work any of that into the plot. So I don't know if we're supposed to also find him ridiculous, that as stupid as this fascist cop is, because he thinks if he's just mean to Ugo, he's going to get what he wants, which, like, by the way, doesn't make any sense, right? He has no, I guess that would make sense if he had leverage, right? But he has no leverage on this guy, and he still just harasses him, and he's like, he'll tell me where the money is if I just say mean stuff. And it's like, that doesn't work, man. You've got nothing on him. There's no power in this situation. But I don't know that I'm supposed to have the sympathy that I do have for the other one. So I guess it's just supposed to illustrate the political differences and perhaps kind of illustrate the vibe at the time, which is like, not just, let's say, literally in police, but more in politics in general, is that, but, you know, maybe the vibe is that both the more conservative / right wing response to the chaos in Italy, but also the more left response to the chaos in Italy, that neither one is actually helping anything, because we never see these cops do anything copy, like, at all. They don't do anything. And so maybe it's the message is something along the lines of both of these extremes are failing us, you know, which I don't really buy into as an idea, but I think might work in the context of the movie, you know.
I mean, you'd also would have to read a little in it to take that. I mean, from the context of the movie, you're exactly right. The movie seems to make the commissioner look like a fool, right? You even see Ugo, like, not laugh in his face, but certainly mock him to his face. While the vice commissioner is shown as being more sensible. He kind of talks down to the commissioner to be like, look, your whole method is wrong. You got to be, these are people from the South, right? I mean, they're coming up to the North and they're not being supported and there's no social programs and stuff like that. And maybe he is meant to be seen as a little soft. I noticed even watching, I remember, I'm like, I recognize that actor. He plays the priest brother of Tuco in The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. He has kind of a sympathetic face generally. And it's, I think you're, if you're not supposed to agree with him, he's definitely presented more sympathetically than the
other. I agree. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. So it's a little odd. I don't know exactly what the movie is trying to say, but I will say that I'm glad, you know, again, we've been surprised again and again with the complexity of the politics that we've seen in a lot of these movies. This is a movie that does not embrace any clear side of that. And maybe that's the thing that it's most saying, is that neither side has a direct answer to the brutality of these criminals. I'm going to ask about the soundtrack in a second, Liam. I wanted to ask you also about the opening sequence in this movie, where it's the money is it changing hands. It's this really well-edited part where you see basically this bag of money being swapped again and again and again. And then it arrives at its final destination and it's opened and they discover that it's all a blank. It's all fake money inside. And then you see in this a series of really brutal scenes that you see Rocco and some of his helpers, they go and track down the people who were involved in the exchange, get them all together and attack them, try to get them all to say that they stole the money. And then they tie them up at the beach, put them in a little cave and fucking dynamite them to death. What did you think of that sequence?
I mean, it's very well done and compelling. We are not given hardly any context, though. So no. The whole time I'm thinking, is this going to culminate in anything? Like, where are we going with this? But it was kind of fun to watch. And it definitely put, in my mind, context. Like, what it does do, while it isn't clear right away how it connects to the plot, what it does do is establish, like, these are bad people, right?
Yes.
And it takes away... And honestly, you know, this is probably more evidence that I should have gotten my shit together watching the movie. It takes away whatever romanticism you might have about these criminals.
That's
right?
True.
Like, look at these awful fucks, right? I guess I just didn't realize it because Ugo seems to be not on their side. I felt all the sympathy for him, and he's just like them, right? Given the right scenario, he'd probably put some random people in a cave and blow them up too. I don't know.
That's exactly right, but I think it's one of those magic of movies type things, right? You see this brutality from these people, and then you see someone in the as the movie starts who is against these people, so he has to be the good guy, even right. though, like you said, he could just as easily have been the person on the beach blowing up these people. It's just about circumstance.
Yeah, and I think going back to what you were saying before, that's the problem I have with this, the inclination I have to agree with this, like, by the way, randomly leftist cop. There's never an explanation why this cop is a fucking socialist, right? Like, it never.
How did he end up as a cop?
Yeah, it's so weird, right? But I think the movie is so cynical about all of these criminals, right? There's never the sympathetic criminal who's trapped in a situation he can't change, right? That it really makes me think there has to be some distance between the movie and what this other police officer, this commissar, is saying, right? Because it doesn't play out in what we're seeing.
Can you imagine a cop on the NYPD, like, who is like a vocal socialist, and how that would play in that situation? It's hard to imagine how any of those pieces would have fit together. Maybe things were just different in Italy in the 70s. We've certainly been reinforced that idea a lot from what we've seen here.
Yeah. I don't know. But yeah, that whole opening sequence was really like, well, first of all, it shows that they got, you know, how mad they are that this, you know
what I mean? Like, so upset.
It's a fucking nightmare, right? But I think also just their willingness to be brutal, I think, is supposed to set us up for what we're seeing. So, like, when they are coming at Ugo, even though he keeps his cool a lot of the time, these are not soft men, right? No. Like, at no point are we like, eh, they're full of shit. They can't touch Ugo. It's like, I don't know. I saw him blow up some people in a fucking beach cave. So, clearly, these people are not afraid to, like, cause trouble, you know?
Before we started recording, Liam, I tried to talk to you about the soundtrack to this movie, and it did not seem to have registered very much with you. But one of the things this movie is best known for is its soundtrack, which was composed by Luis Bacalov, as well as the progressive rock band Osana. Do you have any memories at all about the music in this movie?
Yeah, I was just messing with you, Doug.
I thought you were, because it would be hard not to notice at least the main theme of this.
I don't know that I was invested as you are. Like, I understand what you're saying, that this is what the movie's known for. It just, to me, seemed like a good soundtrack to one of these kind of movies. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't stand out to me in the sense where I was like, fuck, man, like, what is even happening here? Like, I need to look this up. I just was like, oh, man, the music in this works pretty well. And I think some of the scenes, I don't want to say that the movie isn't good in and of itself, but there were scenes that I felt like I was more invested because the music was adding a sense of excitement that maybe the scene wouldn't have on its own, or it was keeping me kind of invested in what was happening in a way.
Certainly when he goes to get the money.
Yeah,
like,
100%.
Because they play the main theme in kind of the most important parts of the movie, which it starts as like these violins playing and getting more and more intense. And then it transitions into this crazy Jethro Tull sounding jazz flute part. And that's played in the very opening scene, and it's played during the big shootout, and it's played during when Ugo goes to get the money. But when he's getting the money, he's just driving places and going through toll booths,
right?
And then going and picking up the stuff. But yeah, it adds a little bit of energy to that, at least.
Yeah, I think that scene is supposed to have more tension because we're supposed to believe that he's trying to do this so quickly that no one will put together that he was at the shootout.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah.
But it's not. Again, it's not that it's bad filmmaking, but without that music, I don't think it would be nearly as exciting as it is.
What do you think about progressive rock music, Liam?
Not for me, no thank you.
Nope, not a big fan of any progressive rock groups. How about Emerson, Lake, and Palmer?
No, come on.
I'm just asking you questions. How about Yes?
No.
How about the aforementioned Jethro Tull?
I'm cool, man. I don't need that kind of thing.
All right. I do like Jethro Tull, I have to admit. I listened to a lot of Jethro Tull when I was... that's why I enjoyed the soundtrack so much. It reminded me of Jethro Tull. Then again, there isn't that many progressive rock bands that include a flute.
Sure. Yeah.
I'm gonna move off the topic before you lose even more respect for me, Liam. This is not an action-packed movie. This isn't like even The Italian Connection, which has some big kind of memorable like car chases and things like that. This movie is very much about... The tension of sequences, like that opening segment. There's one later on, as we've already mentioned, where there's more switching up of satchels of money where they end up just blowing up people. It's all about cross-cutting for the most part. But there is still some notable action, like the big kind of slaughter of the Americano and his men. And, of course, the ending as well. Any of the action stick out to you, Liam?
Well, you already mentioned it as being exciting for you as well. But that shootout at the end really carries a lot of weight. Some of the action is real small, right? It's just Ugo getting pissed and knocking out some guys, or just him getting harassed. Like, it's not a ton of like crazy shootouts per se. There's just a few here and there, but that ending is so climactic, and we really see why there is a fear of Chino, right? Like, before that, he's just an old mafia guy. Like, who fucking cares? And at the time, he's in like a silly t-shirt, like tank top. Like, not compelling that he's a scary dude. And then he shows up, and multiple men's with machine guns are taken out by his little, you know, whatever that is, PP7 or whatever the fuck. Like, this dude just, like, because he's not an asshole, is just like, all right, you're going to come around the corner? Well, there you go, you're dead. You know? And granted, I'm sure at some point someone would watch that and go, this is unrealistic. But that's not the point. The point is that, like, we're understanding why, even though there's clearly a lot of animosity towards this dude, if they were going to try to take him out, it was going to be in secret, right? They weren't going to come at him head on. And it wasn't secret enough because he fucks them all up, you know?
Actually, speaking of guns, just for a moment, Liam, one of the things that we really liked on our previous episode was the gun that Jean-Pierre Belmondo used in the film that we covered on the last episode. Which I later found out was the Beretta 93R. One of the things I said in that episode was about how it reminded me of RoboCop's gun. Liam, it was based, that RoboCop gun was based on that gun.
Whoa.
I did then end up watching a bunch of videos of almost certainly extremely right-wing people using that gun to fire at things.
You know, those guns that are like a handgun, but then it shoots multiple bullets at once, you know? Yes. In fact, there are even guns that'll shoot almost a whole clip with one pull of the trigger. I've always thought those guns were stupid because I just always felt I was more likely to miss. Like, part of the part of the appeal of an automatic handgun is that I'm pulling the trigger a bunch of times and hoping one of the bullets is going to hit. The idea that I'm going to pull, and in that one fucking spot, a bunch of bullets are going to go, I better have picked a good fucking spot. I mean,
I just don't understand how guns work. 12 times in 3 seconds.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I always found that, whereas with a machine gun, like, the difference between this automatic pistol that, like, it's not just automatic, it's like a rapid release. I forget what the term is, but the difference between that and a machine gun is, it seems like with a machine gun, you just pull the trigger and then you spray, like you're putting out a fire with a fire hose.
Exactly, right.
Which, again, is not good. I don't know how many people listen to this who are gun people. So there might be someone going, that's not what you would do, Liam. That's not my point. I'm talking about in the context of a movie. I'm watching a movie and I'm seeing people fight in the movie. And it always seems like machine gun people can just spray bullets everywhere. That makes more sense to me than I'm going to pull the trigger. A bunch of bullets are going to go in the one fucking spot I was pointing at with my little pistol. I've always thought, like, man, you better be a good fucking shot or else you just wasted a bunch of bullets for no reason.
You're right. It doesn't really make a lot of sense because you could just, like, pull the trigger a second time if you wanted to, like, shoot faster in one spot. I mean, I understand that there's probably very specific scenarios where that very cool Beretta would be very useful. Like when RoboCop is shooting a guy in the dick, obviously.
Obviously.
And, you know, if you are a robot man, a robot cop, you probably would need a gun because he doesn't have to worry about the accuracy of the pointing. Liam, he's already got it in his robot brain.
That's true. This is why I don't trust robots.
Liam, we've already talked a lot about the ending of this movie. Poor Ugo gets betrayed by this woman who has been fucking this Luca guy the entire time. But what happens after that? You already mentioned it already, but let's establish it. Ugo gets turned on. Not turned on. He gets the money. He goes to Nelly with the money basically to get her. He's like, we're going to go to Beirut together. And she at first is like, yes, oh, right. And then she's like, Luca, shoot him. And Luca is the guy she's been fucking. And he comes out and he fucking mows down Ugo, kills him in cold blood. And then what happens?
Okay, you skipped something now, Doug.
Yes, I did skip something.
He shoots him once and then Ugo, who's now suddenly You know, the strongest man ever. I think we're meant to believe he kills Nelly with just a couple of punches to the face.
I don't know if he kills her. He only punches her once. I mean, not only, but I mean, just in the context of whether
she's at least seriously hurt, right?
She is seriously hurt by the one punch that he does. There's just a realization as soon as he's shot in the back and she's yelling, he's like, she fucked me. I'm going to punch her so hard, I'm going to kill her. Like, I'm only laughing in the context of the movie, not in real life.
No, yeah. And it is, I mean, to be fair, you know, one of our concerns is always violence against women or whatever. But this is not an abuse situation, Doug. This man is about to die. So it's hard for me to feel as bad because I'm like, well, he's trying to just, you know, he's pissed. I get it. So then our man Luca, who, by the way, I don't know anything about Luca. He just seems like he sucks, just his whole vibe, you know?
Yep.
He's trying to revive Nelly, which, again, maybe she's just knocked out. It really looked like she died, honestly. So he's Rocco, who really is the secret hero of the movie, comes in, and he realizes immediately what's happened, which is that Nelly and Luca have betrayed Ugo and killed him. And he is so filled with righteous anger that he murders Luca with his bare hands, and he only lets go of Luca when the police come in and like pry him off of him. I guess because the police have figured out that maybe Ugo does have the money, so they're like coming to get him, and instead they find Rocco murdering Luca. And I'll be honest, Doug, not only was I confused by the change in Ugo, I also at the end was like, okay, is this just a cool ending, or are we supposed to think this is funny? Because I don't know if that, just the way it's filmed, it's almost like it's funny, Rocco. And I'm like, I don't know if it's funny, guys. I don't know if that's where I want to go with this. But maybe, I don't know. I couldn't really tell. But I will say, it's another reminder that Mario Adorf is good at a lot of different things, because that's such a switch. But it really works, and you really believe, like, oh, he's going to strangle that kid to death. Because Luca looks like, what, he's like 24 or some shit, you know?
I don't know if the timing of the ending works out, right? With Ugo, he leaves the police department, and Rocco has to stay there. And Ugo goes right to Nelly's house, right? And he's going to grab her, and he tells her on the way, it's like, you know, get your stuff together, we're leaving. He's there, gets killed in like 15 seconds, and then Rocco is right there, and then the cops are there right after that. I don't know, maybe they could make it make sense if you thought about it. Maybe they let Rocco go and then trailed him to where they thought he was going to go. But I don't know if all of it made sense. Yeah, it's brutal. I love that Rocco is like yelling. It's like, you got to salute him. This is Ugo, right? I mean, he really has gained some major respect for him through everything that has occurred. It's brutal. It's pretty great. But Liam, is it the end? It's not really, because there is a direct sequel to this movie that was released in 2020 called Calibro 9, directed by Tony D'Angelo. And also, that movie brings back Barbara Boucher from that first movie. So I guess she did live, Liam.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
What? It's right here on the fucking screen in front of you.
No. What I mean is I wasn't aware of that.
No, I know. That's why I'm giving you information so you can react to it.
Right, but okay.
Okay. Okay, take your time. What's the difficulty here?
No. I just mean, like, I was just going along with the vibe of the show, Doug, and now you're like bummed on my performance. So now I feel like a bummer or something. But yeah, like, it's crazy to think that even happened. Like, that's all I'm saying is, like, I have no idea what the fuck you're talking about. Like, that's crazy. How could that be that even happened? Especially like so long after.
That is wild, right? That is, it's 2020.
The whole thing is kind of insane. And it's, they're like the same, they're like, they're playing the same character. Like, she's playing the same character.
She's the same character, and the main guy in it is the son of son of Ugo. Even though there's no sense that he has a son from what we see in the movie. So maybe they're in the one sex scene that we have in this movie. That's what happens, is that he impregnates Nelly, and she has a kid.
Huh.
After she recovers from her
horrible
death.
Injury. Well, the idea, like, if they had gotten away, like, was Luca going to raise that kid? Like, that's an interesting twist to make, but I don't know. Yeah, I don't know, Doug. I don't think I'd want to watch that, honestly.
I'm curious about it. I haven't heard anything about it, so I don't really know. But I might check it out simply because it's such an odd idea, right? It must be filmed, you would think, as a tribute to these kind of Eurocrime movies of the 70s. So that in and of itself makes me a little interested in it. And also the fact that it would be a tribute without being like a comical, theoretically, not a comical tribute. It doesn't sound like it at the very least. So yeah, maybe I'll check out 2020's Calibro 9. Liam, any final thoughts on Calibre 9?
I mean, just because I'm confused about the ending doesn't change the fact that it's really good. And I remember that we really liked The Italian Connection, now that I remember which one it is. and I remember really liking The Boss when I saw that. So I feel like I'm pretty in on this director. Like this is pretty solid. And if for some reason someone made it all the way through, don't think because we ruined the surprise that you shouldn't watch the movie if you haven't seen it, because I think it's still worth seeing. And I'm really impressed by a number of the performances in the movie, you know.
The movie's very easy to find if you want to check it out. It's you can find it on YouTube, for one thing, in the English dub at the very least. I think on Plex, they have it for free streaming in Italian with subtitles. And it's also available on Blu-ray, various Blu-rays. And up until recently, it was actually on the Criterion Channel in their Italian Crime Collection as well. Maybe that'll come back at some point. Speaking of great directors, Liam, on the next episode of Wild in the Streets, we might have the best director that we've been featuring yet, and that's Mario Bava, who in 1974 directed Rabid Dogs, a movie that I've always wanted to see. I think actually this has a remake as well, a modern remake. But have you ever checked out Rabid Dogs?
I don't think so. It doesn't look familiar to me. And I know when it comes to Bava, I've mostly seen the more I wouldn't, not that they're giallo per se, but kind of giallo movies. I guess some of the older ones were, but the ones that feel like horror, and I guess there was also more of a gothic-y one I've seen, but my man directed a bunch of stuff and I haven't really dug very deep at all into his filmography.
You can make the case, Liam, that Mario Bava invented the giallo, particularly
with that's right. Blood and Black Lace is one of the ones I've covered. And I guess in a way kind of kicked off the slasher boom with Bay of Blood, right? Or whatever their name.
Twitch yeah, absolutely.
Death Nerve or whatever, yeah.
Hatchet for a Honeymoon and $5 for an August Moon. I mean, he really, he kicked it in. And that was even after a lengthy successful career with Black Sabbath and Planet of the Vampires, all sorts of odd shit that he got into. Just a superior filmmaker in all sorts of different ways. I know Rabid Dogs isn't always collected in with the kind of Eurocrime movies that we've covered on this show, but I still think that it'll fit with the kind of, especially because it's coming right in that midpoint, 1974, and it is, you know, still a crime-based movie. I think it'll still work. If it doesn't, I guess we'll find out on the next episode of Wild in the Streets. Liam, if people want to check out more episodes of Wild in the Streets, our examination, we're still neophytes, so I think we're 15 episodes into this podcast, Liam, of Eurocrime and Poliziotteschi movies of the 1970s and beyond. What's the best way for them to do so?
Well, over at cinepunks.com, CinePunx, our latest episodes, as well as a whole family of podcasts over there. So if you head over there, you can check that out, as well as some writing and coverage of various newer movies. If people want to head to our website, cinesmorgasbord.com, they can not only get into our archive, but really see all the different topics we cover, whether that's the film careers of specific actors like Carol Kane, Eric Roberts, Vic Diaz, Steve Buscemi, also other kind of topics, whether it's our exploration of genre film fests or our new series of Selling Out, where we actually talk about movies that people have seen before. Whatever it is, all that is collected by topic at cinemasmorgasbord.com.
Yes, and if you enjoy what you're listening to, why don't you leave us a review on your podcast provider of choice, or why don't you tell a friend, whether it be this podcast or one of our other podcasts that are focused on a topic like Eric Roberts or Jackie Chan or Steve Buscemi or George Kennedy or Alejandro Jodorowsky, all that over at cinemasmorgasport.com or at cinemasmorg on Twitter. Speaking of Twitter, I'm back there as well, at Doug_Tilley, that's T-I-L-L-E-Y. I'm also on Blue Sky, or you can do a search for cinemasmorgasport on Facebook as well. Liam, anything? Any other announcements that you have to make?
No.
You can always pick up great shirts over at roughcutfanclub.com. I don't know what will be up at the time that this episode gets released, but keep checking back. There's always exciting stuff there. But for now, we need to take a little break. We're going to be back very soon with 1974's Rabid Dogs. Good night, everyone.
Night, night.